our opportunity for us to share our collective learnings and our reflection groups together back to the entire group. But this morning's plenary is an exciting and unique one in which we'll have opportunities to first hear from some practical applications of theory into different contexts. So how some wonderfully intelligent and dedicated individuals working with their organizations have applied concepts such as those we've been exploring this week into some unique circumstances. But secondly, an opportunity for you as participants to deepen inquiry into some of our bigger concerns we've identified and to begin thinking about how we might develop personal and professional strategies to apply our learnings and move towards action. So, of course, I'd like to take this moment to thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity. But really to thank you for engaging so deeply into our collective inquiry this week. I'll introduce first all of our morning speakers, and I'm trying to do it in a slightly different way. I want to humanize them a little bit more. We've probably had a chance to discuss with my fellow panelists some of the finer points of their work, but how well do we really know them? So I put them under the lamp yesterday and asked them some very deep and personal questions, and I'm going to share those with you as a way of introducing them this morning. But before I give those introductions, I do want to give you a little bit of instructions for how to listen to this morning's plenary. I'm going to encourage you in listening to the stories they have to share about their work to try to identify the practical strategies and ways in which they've sought to apply some of the concepts and theories that we've been exploring this week, particularly related to human rights learning. So what is the process? How have they implemented this particular process? And the theory behind the work that they're approaching. Because these panelists are here to be catalysts for your own provocative thoughts and inquiry into application in your own settings. So listen with this fine-tuned ear this morning. And I also, of course, we as the organizers of the Institute have a particular interest in finding ways of moving these types of learning experiences into action and creating more sustainable opportunities that further this work. I'd just like to take just one moment to share with you an anecdotal story of how we've been seeking to apply these concepts and theories into our own work. So about 4 years ago now, many members of the IIE community came together and were questioning how we could sustain this type of learning in our own communities. Because one of the things that and feelings that you may be feeling later today is this feeling of deflation. We have this wonderful inertia and energy together, and this sense of hope that we can do all of these things. But in the back of our brains, sometimes we have this notion that, okay, at the end of today, we have to go back to what we might call reality, where there's not the supportive group of colleagues and educators who understand the principles that we're seeking to live and the methods and processes with which we facilitate the kind of learning we've been doing this week. So a group of educators came together from the IIE community, and we conceived of a way of adapting the International Institute model into communities. And we've called that the CIPE, for community-based institutes on peace education. And I don't want to talk in great length or detail now about that, but maybe I'll add a focus group up for people who might want to look at ways of sustaining and developing cohorts of educators and communities as a way of moving forward the peace agenda. But in short, you can find a lot of this information on the IIPE website about the community-based institutes. But I want to just share one story about how our colleagues in Colombia who have developed a national network of educators that they call CPE Columbia, has been able to really work principally through principles of peace to create a strategy for change, working through NGOs, governments, government agencies, grassroots, teachers, policymakers, through the country of Colombia. So our colleagues there, coordinate CPE Colombia, are particularly gifted ferrying of educators, but they're also really wonderful facilitators of experiential learning. And the opportunity that I've had to be with them in Bogota been very eye-opening. Last November, I was there meeting with a group of policymakers from the UN, from the Ministry of Education, group of educators involved in the CPE Columbia network to talk about some practical strategies for moving forward an agenda of citizen competency, which is sort of the government policy, educational policy in which peace education is most relevant in the country. And we walk into this room of a group largely of what I might normally identify as bureaucrats. And on the tables are large pieces of papers and markers. And on these pieces of paper are large mandalas. You know what a mandala is? And there are no instructions given. And for the first half hour of this strategy meeting, we have policymakers and teachers and others sitting together, critically drawing and filling in and creating patterns and having conversation. And this seems strange and odd enough, but the philosophy that our colleagues brought, they said every opportunity that we have to engage people in discussion around peace education, we have to apply the practice that we're talking about. So this activity, which of course they processed and talked through before they began the meeting, was a way to humanize this opportunity and this meeting, shifting it from a working meeting into a more of a meeting where we're engaging as human beings. And so this is just one of many ways that they sought to do it. So engaging with a group of policymakers and something that you might do also with elementary school children, it may seem strange, but it really shifted the culture and it opened their eyes. And out there's this one of our colleagues we work with there has a job of working on sort of a culture peace agenda between government agencies in Colombia. Been doing this job for about 10 years, and I was interviewing him as we're trying to make a small documentary of CPE Columbia. And I asked him, what is it that CPE Columbia has brought to your work that's different than from before? And his comment was a simple reflection of what I just shared. He said, before, we knew each other as professional colleagues. And we came into the room, we identified a task and a goal, worked and we accomplished it. And that was that. So now we know each other as human beings. When I walk into the room, I know Betty Reardon not just as the founder of IIPE, but as a person who's an inspired dancer in an alternative universe, as a person who deeply cares about her nephews who are life for life, as a person who has had an array of experiences. So now they're connecting on this human level, he says. And it brings them together with more conviction and purpose and in a new way of living. So this is kind of a one way in which people have found to apply some very deep philosophical concepts and theory into everyday situations. And working particularly primarily by identifying principles and finding every way they can to identify them and apply them. All right, so with that, to humanize us, first, so you know me as coordinator of the International Institute on Peace Education. My favorite color, you probably don't know, is green. My favorite fruit is a banana. When I was up until about the age of 12, I dreamed of growing up and having a career as a semi-truck driver. And of course, I think I'm doing my dream job now, but in an alternate universe where peace education might not be needed, I see myself as being either an artist or a musician. Okay, so, and then I'm going to introduce our colleagues here in order of presentation, which is slightly different than what's in your program. And we're going to start and hear first today from our colleague Saima Anwar from Pakistan. And Saima is working for, this is what she does, Save the Children UK in Bangladesh. This morning she will be speaking on minority rights and empowering indigenous communities. Saima's favorite color is blue. Her favorite fruit is the mango, and she dreamed of being a writer as a child. And in an alternative universe, she dreams of being a musician or a singer. Second this morning, we will hear from Jasmine Galase from the Philippines. Jasmine is the Associate Director of the Center for Peace Education at Miriam College in Quezon City. Her favorite color is yellow. Her favorite fruit is also the mango. When she was a child, she dreamed of being a lawyer and following her father's footsteps. But you can ask her this later. That dream was quickly shattered. And in an alternative universe, this is my favorite, she dreams of being a food taster. The title of Jasmine's presentation has changed slightly. It is now Doing What We Teach, Our Work as Academic Advocates. And then finally this morning, we'll be hearing from Paula from Colombia. She works for Grupo Bolivar and Peace Games. Her favorite color is white. Her favorite fruit is the tangerine. When she was a child, she dreamed of growing up and becoming a fireman. And in an alternate universe, she dreams of being a dancer or an actress. Oh, yeah. And her title this morning has also changed. She will be speaking about ethnography through discourses of movement, the fight for human dignity. So, I now turn it over to Simon.
Are human rights always guaranteed? And they're not, as we see in many democracies across the world. And we've heard from so many people, which makes me think that the context, you know, we work in different contexts, but the issues are somehow similar. So I'm going to talk about a project that we're doing in one area in Bangladesh, which is focused on some indigenous communities, and using that as to focus on some of the issues related to the rights of minorities and what can be done. And I feel this is very relevant because even in the context of Hungary, we see, you can relate it maybe to some of the issues related to the Roma minority here, and we've heard in Japan and in other countries, you know, all throughout the week that there are issues related to minorities living within a country which often are sort of left out and not addressed. So moving into a couple of issues that I would like to focus on during this presentation or for us to think more particularly about the rights of all citizens in a democracy, whether all rights of all citizens are guaranteed in a democracy, specifically the rights of minority groups. You know, I think more about those groups of people, especially the issue for that the minorities are facing is kind of the preservation of their own cultural identity. And culture is very, very broad. It can relate to your traditions, it can relate to your language. And what I'm going to be talking about as a project is focused more on preservation of the languages of these communities. And so that's my focus. And what I've learned is language is something that is very, very central to any community's identity. And often it's very political, and you know, people fight over it, and you know, it's a constant. I think it needs to be recognized. It's a core part of every community's identity, language. And then the relationship between language and education. Because this project that I'm going to talk about is on multilingual education, allowing different communities an opportunity to learn, the children to learn in their own languages, and for the communities to sustain those languages, along with, you know, other languages which are mainstream, which are more applicable in a context, but promoting a variety of, so recognizing this diversity. And then education as a means of empowerment. You know, we heard throughout this week that nothing is better than education. Education, education, education. Because in every context, if we believe that if we can educate, provide a quality education, that is the key to actually promoting, that is the fundamental basis of promoting other human rights. And that's what we have observed in this project, and that's what I've sort of thought about. So I just wanted to. Human rights for all children, you know, and this is guaranteed in the Convention of the Rights of the Children. And specifically, this is what it says about the rights of indigenous communities and the use of mother language. It says in Article 30 of the CRC that no indigenous child should be denied the right to use his or her language and practice his or her culture. And this is a commitment that all states have already taken on, most states are committed to this. And also from a rights-based approach, you know, because often when we design projects or programs like this, we have to make other arguments such as, you know, this is good for the economic development of the country or whatever, or other way. But from taking a rights-based approach, and when you design, you know, I just wanted to make these two points, that the exercise of the right cannot be decided by the number of speakers of any given language. You know, even if there are 500 people, you shouldn't have to be made to convince people, you know, why it's important for them to learn in their own language. And the exercise of right cannot be decided in terms of economic costs. But yet, we can show that, you know, it has other things as well. So why mother tongue and bilingual education? In many, many countries, research has shown, and it's proven fact, through experience as well, through practical implementation, that children learn better in their own language, especially when they start early education. And in bilingual schools, generally children are happier, they participate more, they're more active learners, and also have a higher self-esteem overall. And this I see it actually happening in the schools in which we work. And then, but more than a strategy to improve the quality of education, it definitely contributes to the quality of education. We believe that the use of indigenous languages is an essential right that is recognized by the CRC. In the context of Bangladesh, which is where we're working on this project, just wanted to tell you a little bit that the International Mother Language Day that UNESCO celebrates on the 21st of February, is designated by the UN as the International Mother Language Day. That's based on a movement that started in Bangladesh. In 1952, a number of university students who were protesting for the right to use their own language, you know, Bangladesh used to be a part of Pakistan, and the national language was Urdu. But Bengali, they felt very strongly about their language. And in fact, that was where the whole independence movement of Bangladesh arose from. It was from that language issue, and that they decided to start the movement for independence. And these students were killed during that demonstration by the Pakistani police. And to commemorate that, which was on the 21st of February, the is the International Mother Language Day has been designated by UNESCO. So just wanted to point that out in the overall context of Bangladesh. Now, the area where we are working, and it's very ironic because you see the end of these people are still fighting for their right to preserve their language, whereas in a country which actually believes so strongly about this issue of language, it's very ironic that some people are still denied their right to their own language. This is a small area of hills, and more than it's in the southeast of Bangladesh and bordering India and Myanmar. And some of what you saw in Arthur's presentation, it's more some communities have a link with some parts in India living in that area as well. So it's bordering India and Myanmar, and there are about 1.3 million people living there, and they belong to 13 different ethnic minority groups, and all of them have a different culture, and they speak an entirely different language. They're very, very diverse from each other even, and from the mainstream Bengali population, of course. The ratio of this population, just to show that recently, in the past 20 years, there has been a movement to settle Bengali people in that area in order to upset the demographic balance in that area. So whereas the indigenous groups used to be the only people living there, now it's almost 50-50 distribution. And that's creating a lot of problems as well, because these people who are coming in as settlers are actually, their lands are being given to the settlers, and these people are left, are dispossessed of their land. And just quickly, 1971, Bangladesh got its independence from Pakistan. In 1976, an insurgency started in the Chittagong Hill Tracts, and now the conflict started for their rights. Basically, it was, I think, for land rights. And then a peace negotiation started, and after 20 years, in 1997, a peace accord was signed, so that stopped the actual violent conflict in the area. And what that peace accord actually is quite comprehensive, and it guarantees political, economic, social, cultural, and educational rights to these people. And it also specifically mentions the fact that children from these communities have a right to education in their mother tongue and will be given that. But the reality is that even sort of 11 or 12 years later, not one of these things has been implemented, which was agreed at signing of that peace accord. So those people are still waiting for this. The education situation is pretty bad there. You can see, compared to the overall figures for Bangladesh, the situation in the CHD is very bad. And so only 53% of the children enroll, and then out of that, 60% drop out. So this is the project that we sort of implement, that Save the Children is implementing. In Bangladesh, in Bengali, it's called Shisho Kamadan, which actually means empowering children. And this is the goal of the project, so that they get an inclusive education and also participate in the decisions that make them, that affect them. Some of the steps that we went through, one was, of course, developing a writing system. Some of these languages were becoming extinct, so they didn't even have a written script or any literature. So the process was that we formed some language committees comprising of, you know, people from that community, and they decided which script they wanted to use. So some of them decided to use the Burmese script, others had their own script still, they hadn't lost it, and some decided to just adopt the Roman script. Then developing materials with these language committees, using local artists and writers, they facilitated workshops so that they could come up with materials, stories, big books that were in their languages and were also culturally relevant, you know, reflected the. And then training local teachers, that was very, very difficult, because most of the time these teachers didn't even know how to read and write their own languages. I mean, as a spoken language it's used, but it's not as I said, communities were involved right from the beginning, because language is a very political issue, and if you try to impose anything, it will not be accepted. So they decided on all this, and then all also contributed. And what we did was establish pre-primary schools, because this is a three-year-old project, and we started off setting up primary school, pre-primary schools. These are two-year program, and the idea is that at the end of the 2 year, there is a bridging, so the children learn the Bangla language as well as their own language, so that when they go into primary school, they're ready for the school. But this is not enough. What we would like to do is actually take this program into some of the primary schools, but those are government schools, so there's still some challenges in introducing this program in those schools. But even this is making a lot of difference in getting more children in school. And then formation of children's groups in primary schools, organizing children, talking to them about their what they think and feel and what would they like to do. And they have some, they do even a lot of advocacy, child-led advocacy. So these children's groups often identify social issues and have theaters or songs. And Bangladesh is a very, very rich culturally, and everybody likes to sing and dance. And so even the children, they use that as a medium. Involving parents, and parents are the first people who come and say that they want the children to learn in their own languages. And then mainstreaming these children into primary schools. So almost 100% of the children actually go into school. They don't drop out. And this is what, some of the children have to say, basically. They like coming to school because the teacher teaches me in Tripura, which is his own language, and I like to play, and I want to be a teacher when I grow up. We talk to children, and I also had a very small video to show you faces of children, but I don't know, I don't have time for that. So in conclusion, what I'd like to say is that the project has had a multifaceted impact, because it started off as an education project to promote better access and better retention in schools. So I think that it has achieved that from what I have observed. But it has also contributed to the preservation and protection of local culture and languages, and basically preserving these languages from becoming extinct. And the work is going on now. We're at a point where the communities are working on developing dictionaries in their own languages. So there's a side-by-side, the education component and then the working with the language committees to somehow build their capacity to develop more materials in their own languages. And what I've observed is that the process was as important as the result. The process of actually engaging the communities, teaching them about some of the things. For instance, linguists were brought in to organize workshops, and then they developed all the materials themselves. They wrote the stories for children. They drew the pictures for those books. So I feel that there's a lot of ownership in the communities of this, and they want to continue with this work. And just in conclusion, what I would like to say is that this type of work is very, very important, basically to preserve the languages of indigenous communities and other cultural practices which are gradually becoming extinct. But more than that, it is also necessary to work with the rest of the population to promote a culture which respects cultural diversity and enrichment between cultures in order to establish a framework for inclusive democracy.
So I started to stammer and forgetting my lines because it was the Betty Riordan. So, and again, today, Betty Riordan is in front of me, so I thought I should go this way so that I won't stammer too much, okay? But anyway, she's definitely not threatening, it's just that. Well, let me begin with an anecdotal story also. this month, last February, I was in Tokyo to attend a meeting on arms control. I was invited with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs together with other members of civil society and academe. And I remember, if you can, I'm the one in white there. There was one professor who said that, you know, we as academics have no business looking for solutions to problems. Our business is to look for problems, not solutions. And because we do that because we're in the ivory tower, definitely not grounded. I was shocked with that statement. You know? So, I was surprised because that definitely is not me, because I'm into peace education. And I know that in peace education, we do not just build awareness and cultivate values, but we also encourage students to take practical action. That's what I know. And so this morning, I would like to share with you our work as academic advocates, which I thought do mean what we teach. So in the Center for Peace Education, these are the different dimensions we focus on when we teach peace education, as you can see on screen. And when we teach upholding human dignity, this is what we tell our students. Men and women are equal in rights and in dignity, but we try to walk our talk. So beyond words, as you can see the lips with the legs, we are actually helping draft a national action plan to implement UN Security Council Resolution 1325, which goal is to increase women's participation in conflict resolution processes and peace building. And we are also in the process of drafting a national action plan to implement 1820, which goal is to protect women from sexual violence in situations of armed conflict. When I come back to the Philippines, I'll start the roadshow, going to different regions to consult women on what they want in the national action plan. And when we're done, after a year, we're going to present this to the President of the Philippines for her signature, and this will become an executive order. When we teach protecting human rights, we tell our students that people who are not taking part in armed hostilities should be protected. Beyond words, we are also part of a third-party network that monitors the agreement between our government and the Communist Party of the Philippines. It's a long-standing conflict of 40 years, almost as old as I am. But these two warring groups decided that they are going to respect human rights and the rules of war despite. And so our work is to actually, if you can see the map of the Philippines there, our group, the Sulong Caril, went, you know, in different places in the country and told indigenous peoples in armed conflict areas that these are your rights, even there's armed conflict going on. These are the rules of war. And we help them develop a monitoring instrument so that they can report human rights violations or violations to the rules of war when they happen. When we teach sharing the Earth's resources, we tell our students that Earth's resources should be justly shared. But beyond words, you hold an annual fundraising campaign dubbed Rice Porridge for Mindanao that helps fund projects such as education assistance, construction of facilities, and purchase of equipment for a partner school in Mindanao. And you can see here in the photos our students in high school and grade school actually enjoy the porridge because they actually know that this money will go to something very good. When we teach promoting respect for diversity, we tell our students that all humans are brothers and sisters, regardless of race, ethnicity, religion, gender, sex, and socioeconomic status. Beyond words, we have a twinning project with a school attended by Muslims in war-torn Mindanao. William College, where I am, is actually a Catholic school and attended by women. And the theme of the twinning project is to build bridges of understanding and peace. Because there are a lot of biases between and against, you know, Muslims and Christians. And so we began actually with letter writing. Our students started to write letters to the Muslims in Mindanao, to the students, and vice versa. We started with something trivial, like what's your favorite television show, who is your favorite movie star, until we discussed more serious issues, like what is your situation right now. And we also have organized a newsletter, which you can hardly see on screen, or maybe I haven't clicked it yet. Okay. And in there, they have reflected their thoughts, and they have poems and essays, narratives, you know, and the exchange of letters. And we actually succeeded in making them meet a couple of times. So we brought the Muslim students to Metro Manila, and I remember vividly, friends, that on the first day that they met, in the assembly, one lady said, one girl from Mindanao asked our Catholic students, how do you feel whenever you hear that there's bombing in our place? And one grade 7 student went to the microphone and said, "We just don't know how alarmed you are. There was a time we decided to go to the chapel together and pray for you." That the Muslim girl cried, and all the other Muslims in the room cried as well, and there was no dry eye in the room after that. So it is how powerful contact theory is, you know, that we have to give opportunities to students of different cultures to see each other and become friends, you know, these biases can really be greatly reduced. When we teach challenging the war system, we tell our students that war is not inevitable, that the species that are capable of reaching war are also capable of reaching peace. So what do? We organize and join mass demonstrations and prayer rallies to stop the war, whether the war is in Mindanao, in Burma, or other parts of the world, as you can see on screen. When we teach promoting nonviolence, we tell our students that conflicts can be managed and resolved nonviolently. And beyond words, we train our students to become peer mediators. In fact, there are class officers called peacekeepers, and we train them to mediate in conflicts among their peers. When we teach the concept of controlling the instruments of war, we tell our students that weapons, being instruments of war and crime, must be controlled. And beyond words, we organize arms control lobbying and activities locally and internationally. You can see here that we are part of the weapons destruction. Every year, we egg our Philippine National Police to burn surplus weapons. And then our students just last month went to the commissioner elections to actually appeal for a gun ban during the election period. Because in the Philippines, elections are marred by violence. Hundreds of people are killed. You know, political rivalries are just so intense. And so our students went there, and actually officials of the Commission on Elections came out to speak to us. Our students have also gone to the Congress to lobby our parliamentarians to support an arms trade treaty. And you can see her actually a student, you know, who asked a parliamentarian to sign a letter of support for an arms trade treaty, and her back was used by the parliamentarian to affix his signature. So we also are in a media campaign, so we write letters to the editor, as you can see there. We have gone to many radio stations, television stations, to speak about our cause. When we teach caring for the earth, we tell our students that humans should not outstrip the ability of the earth to regenerate, and we should develop systems that will protect our present and future generations. In Miriam College, among many environmental projects, we have a solid waste management and deposit to recyclables project. So you will see some receptacles in different parts of the school that says DepRec, deposit to recyclables. So students who come, you know, from home, they can deposit their plastic bottles and other recyclables, and proceeds go to a scholarship fund. When we teach cultivating inner peace, we tell our students something that Michael Jackson had said in one song, that if you want to make this world a better place, take a look at yourself and make that change. And so beyond words, we teach our students skills of conflict resolution, because we know that conflicts can actually threaten, you know, inner peace. And we also attend with our students interfaith gatherings and prayers, as you can see on screen. And then we teach, of course, generally, building a culture of peace, and we tell our kindred partners that peace education is a pathway to peace. Beyond words, we organize a national network of peace educators. So there's a national organization now in the Philippines of peace educators we call the Peace Education Network, and we are actually in the process of organizing a Southeast Asia Peace Education Network. We have invited people from different parts of Southeast Asia a couple of times, and because we are in the process of organizing a Southeast Asia network. We also have declared our school a zone of peace, and if you're going to visit, you will see upon the entrance that there is a declaration there, the one on your right, etched in stone, that Miriam College is a zone of peace, and what we believe in are actually stipulated in that declaration. We also have systematically integrated peace education in our curriculum, and we have offered it as a separate course and integrated in our social studies and other courses. And we develop instructional materials, as you can see on screen. We also helped make the President of the Philippines sign an executive order that would mainstream peace education in the curriculum. And Loretta Castro, the director of the office, is really so active in this. So you can see parts of the executive order on screen that the president signed. And we have brought peace education to other sectors in our society. the religious, members of street gangs, the police, the military, and the parents, among others. You can see on screen that I am giving a parenting seminar to parents in southern Philippines. Are we in the ivory tower? Is it true? That's what the professor in Tokyo said. Are we in the ivory tower because we dream of a world free from war and the threat of it? Because we dream of a world where justice and equality prevail? Are we in the ivory tower because we dream of a world where every person's full potential is actualized? Are we in an ivory tower because we dream of an earth restored? My answer is no, because we do our share in helping make these dreams come true. Thank you very much.
While Paula is setting up her PowerPoint, we'll just have moments of reflection here. Very, very beautiful comments by both Saima and Nesmin about the practical application of theory into practice. And Saima, of course, looking at the inconsistency between policy, which is the 97 Peace Corps, and the actual implementation of practices of the work of Chief Human Dignity and the work that she's been doing in indigenous communities to empower them to create their own curriculum and learn their own language. With a list that most of us could barely begin to accomplish, ways of walking the talk as educators and activists and advocates. Very impressive. So, Paula?
Yeah. Hello. I'm going to talk to you for work that I've been doing in Colombia. But first of all, I want to thank all of you for being here and just being there for listening. Yesterday we were talking about institutions, and I work for one in my country. I work for a big corporation in Colombia in the area of social responsibility. And this project is in that frame, you know. It's nice to think of it like a bridge between the people who have like power and resources and people who need help and PZ. So I'm like this kind of bridge there in Grupo Bolivar, which is the name of the corporation. So this specific project is a work that I do in one of the most dangerous neighbors in Bogota. So I will just start by saying that, well, ethnography literally means portrait of people. And I plan to share the portrait of the work I've been doing as an anthropologist and peace educator with 45 sexual workers and thieves and their children in one of the most vulnerable and dangerous neighborhoods in Bogota, Colombia, in Bronx. The objective of this task is to end the chain of prostitution and crime that has become a recurring behavior passed on from mothers to children. But in order to accurately portray this situation, I will start by telling you that these 45 sexual workers and thieves and their families involved in the rehabilitation process live on one block away from the most frightened olla, which is this one, a place where living conditions are low beyond the extent of imagination. So this is one block away from the place I work with, and people live like in dirt. And the people that live around La Olla are neighbors of the undesirables, homeless adults and children that have been named unmarked by inequality because they were born in a place where there is no space for human rights or dignity. A place that, according to Foucault, was built by society as the absolute opposite of development and dreamed utopias. So this is one of room, this one, the room of Helena. This is a picture of a boy at the Bronx. Following Foucault's thoughts, we might think of Bronx as a place outside of every place.
nevertheless as an effectively localizable spot that works like a mirror of absence, in which we are able to recognize ourselves from the distance as a shadow of everything that we have chosen not to be. This is how we, as outsiders, started looking at this place when we first realized it was there, when the media began exposing that it was. However, we've never been aware of the fact that in these hideouts, in the midst of weeds and social decomposition under a type of urban life has been rising. We've never been able to fully measure the dimensions of this district and the activities that happen inside of it, because El Bronx is a no place that has been forgotten by outsiders. It's a ghetto with all its human characteristics that demands special codes if you choose to gain access to it. So this is the house where I work with, it's one of the houses where I work, like a small spaces, and it's like very uncomfortable and dirty and it, well. After making a short detour that really described our relationship as outsiders with El Bronx, I would like to return to the conversation in which I was telling you about the community I've been working with. For starters, these 45 families are currently living in very small rooms that serve as setting for prostitution, gun running, and drug dealing, among other criminal activities. And in addition, they've got to face the fact that their homes are still one block away from the Oya, that place in which people have to lie on the street in between piles of garbage and dirt, a place in which the authority of the police and government is absolutely irrelevant and absent. There's no police in there. You will never find authority. Never. That's because these neighbors are ruled by guerrilla and paramilitaries, and so no one can get in there. Yeah. These 45 families struggle every day in order to make enough money to pay the rent, because paying the rent allows them to stay away from falling into the ocean. That's why, in this context, stealing and prostitution become a means towards achieving human dignity. Because throughout every activity that might produce any profit, they're escaping La Olla, the place that reflects their most feared nightmare, a nightmare that constantly haunts their minds and memories due to its unavoidable nearness. I was able to discover this in a movement speech workshop I did with them, and we could, in the workshop, talk about our dreams and nightmares and how we felt about them, and they had to just express what they were feeling, what their nightmares look like in their bodies. So Magali did this thing for expressing how she felt in falling into the Oya. Yes, she was like telling me, I have my kids, but my struggle in everyday life, it's not even for eating, it's for not being there. So that's the expression, you know, it was very, very strong, because all the girls began to talk about it, you know, they just somehow created a safe space in which they could talk about what they were feeling. And that's when ethnography comes. They tell about their stories through these kind of things, and then there you can like know what are they feeling and how they get to manage through it, so you can really work in peace and with them, because they are telling you how are they feeling. They are giving you the product for your work, yes. But why movement? Why ethnography through movement discourses? Because when I first started working with homeless kids back in 2007, in a 6-month food coexistence with them in the tropical rainforest of El Chocó, place where they were taken from rehab and learning, I realized that the communicational codes held in their bodies was the point where I had to get started with. Because by communicating their bodies, I could deepen as an ethnographer and as a PZ, intercultural knowledge, looking into their bodies, I got to see what has meaning for them, because their bodies show the way in which they appropriate space, the way in which they relate with them and the others. Their bodies reveal the material of the social fabric. When I got there, though, I was full of theory. I had the great tool of peace games methodology, but even so, I had to rename and deconstruct my own ideas before using them, because the way in which these kids established relationships with others was traced by rudeness, anger, that this particular behavior was not expressed through words, but through their bodies that had been recipients of all the marks of violence, silence, injustice through their lives. Their bodies that had learned to be rude and aggressive just for the sake of surviving. Bodies that had learned to receive bad treatment. Bodies that had not learned how to give a caress. And this is very, very curious, you know, because you somehow think that, yeah, like we as humans have like this feeling of touching other, of communicating through, just be there, like, and you think that caressing is just so natural, yes, and it is. But for some people, it is so, it's there, but they don't know how to use it because they have never learned. So when you see these moms with their children, they are so rude with them. They're like strong, they take them and grab them, but they love them, but they don't know how to caress them. And it's amazing when you realize this, because it's like, oh, first I have to try to take that out from them. It's not teaching them. It's just like grabbing that thing that they have inside and make them use it as a tool for between them, which are they're very supportive among them, women, and their children. So that's how I think we first start to break chains of prostitution, renaming that kind of a closeness. The same that I saw here happened with the work I'm leading with these 45 families. As I said before, the purpose of this work is to end with the chain of prostitution and crime, but the first place where real signification has to occur is in the relationships they construct with the simple act of touching, of feeling each other, of moving without preventions, because this is a great step towards forgiveness, a great step toward letting the past go and starting all over again. In this way, they are able to rename others and their kids. At the end, this is all about dignity. You know, this is Blanca Jimenez, La Gorda, which means the fat one, the big one. She was a prostitute, and now she dedicates her life for helping other women in the rehab process. And she's my angel. She's my angel. I can get into the neighborhood because of her. If I wouldn't be with her, I will probably be killed inside. You know, like, I get inside with her and I feel very protected. She's like really, really my angel. And once you get inside, and people is confident with you and they just know that you are trustful, you're in the safest place ever. You know, these people is like, you're in the bache. We say in Spanish and, well, in slang. Like, this is a very united community, you know, they're never gonna let you down. But that's why ethnography is so important to me, because I don't ever do my workshops, I don't go there like, hey, this is Pizhead and you have to do this and let's dance. And no, that doesn't work. You have to gain trust first, by talking to them, by what is it, what's happening, what are your dreams, how do you move, how are you feeling? And then you can get there with a proposal. So, well, I was going to say, at the end, it's all about human dignity, which is among every one of us, dignity that does not depend on anyone the dignity that we were born with. And because of this, because it doesn't depend on anyone or anything, just because it's there in each one of us, it has invaluable meaning for everyone, for every sexual worker, thief, kid, baby born there. I'm just embarking into this work. Any suggestions or comments that you may have, they're all received.